This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. What makes a good judge? What makes a successful criminal? And is there really such a thing as a sympathetic criminal? Is it possible that all of us are just one simple twist of fate and one second of bad judgment away from becoming criminals? That's something that Martin Clark ponders in his novels, The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, and more recently, Plain Heathen Mischief. In those books, Martin Clark ponders the wages of sin through characters who might be considered sages of sin. His stories have featured a not-quite-by-the-book small-town judge, a big-city con man, a bigger-city lawyer, a mystic, a shamed minister, all of whom slide down some slippery slopes. In real life, Martin Clark has witnessed a wide spectrum of bad behavior in the form of people who have come into his courtroom. In addition to writing his novels, Martin Clark has worked for years as a circuit court judge in Southern Virginia. And today, Martin Clark is joining us in the studio. Welcome.
And good afternoon, and thanks for the invitation, and thank you for the hospitality once I arrive.
Well, it's great to have you here. And we welcome calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. If you want to weigh in on this idea of judgment, are the best judges the ones who best understand criminal behavior? And is it the same as, say, bad behavior? Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, Martin Clark, in both of your books, very rollicking books, The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living and the more recent Plain Heathen Mischief, there are slides into sin and a sliding scale of sin that you consider here. I imagine there's a lot to mine there.
Well, folks frequently ask me how much of my day job translates into what I write. And I suppose some of the basics do, but Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living features a dissolute, pot-smoking judge. And I'm not that judge. I'll give you that disclaimer very early on. Plain Heathen Mischief does, in fact, feature as its plot trick or the central... I'm told that's not a very good literary term, plot trick.
Why not?
I don't know. It's the theme of the book, or the just the plain old plot that seems too superficial. But be that as it may, the plot trick comes from a case that I actually tried. What I perceived to be an insurance scam, and it was a very fascinating case that actually confounded a jury twice. A jury hung twice. And the plaintiff recovered a six-figure award in the final jury trial, and I was convinced that it wasn't all on the up and up. I have to be careful. It's the lawyer in me. I have to be careful about how I phrase that. It's just my opinion. And I took that. The third time I heard the case, I figured out, I think, what was happening. And maybe that makes me dim, but it took me three times. But I think I figured out essentially the scam, the grift.
What can you tell us what it was?
Let me say this. It's in Plain Heathen Mischief. It's sort of the backbone plot.
Okay.
And I took that sort of skeleton and embellished it and added a little bit of color. But I did get that from my work.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple of scams, we should say, in Plain Heathen Mischief. One of them is this insurance scam about some jewels.
Yes.
And reclaiming the money. The other
yes.
is one where a claim is made that a minister has had sex with a teenager.
Yeah.
So which one was in your real-life trial?
Well, the insurance scam,
okay.
Not the... sadly, the tale of ministers having sex in one context or another, in one faith or another, are all too common.
Right. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. We are talking with Martin Clark, who works as a judge just over the North Carolina border in Southern Virginia, and draws upon a lot of the people who come through his courtroom for the characters in his novels. Two novels out now, and we are talking about them, Plain Heathen Mischief and The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living. Well, talking a little bit more about the story line in plain Heathen Mischief. We have a minister at a Baptist church in Virginia who has to leave because of this accusation against him. He doesn't deny it. In fact, he goes to jail, even though he did not actually do the crime that he's accused of.
And that's true. I think the sort of the tease for that is he is convicted of a crime that he may or may not have done. And the book is, and one thing I'd like to say about the book, I hope it's interesting when we talk about writing and you're asked, what is your book about? And I think as writers, sometimes we give long, sort of ham-fisted, ponderous answers. I hope this book is entertaining most of all. Mm-hmm. And I think as writers, sometimes we get away from that. People say, well, what's the book about? And I guess the short version of this book is that it's sort of the Scarlet Letter crossed with Ocean's 12. I was corrected. I said Ocean's 11 for a while, and the folks who are real good with demographics said, no, it's Ocean's 12 now. You know, you need to hit the right target
but
audience.
You know, the first movie was better than the second.
Did you think so? I liked Ocean's 12. I liked it, and it got such bad reviews, and everyone thought it was sort of, you know, breezy and superficial. That's right up my alley. I like breezy and superficial entertainment. But this isn't Elmer Gantry, and it's not a book that that pokes fun at faith or religion. In fact, it's very much undergirded by a sense of faith.
I think that very much comes through because you do have characters in here. You have Joel, who remains religious, but it does appear that you have characters here who defend both sides of that coin, those who would be who would say they have faith and those who don't. And they're believable characters on both sides.
Well, thank you for saying that. I think that it's interesting that a lot of very decent, spiritual, moral people are not what we would term religious. In this book, Joel's sister is a very grounded, very decent, very honest, at her core, very spiritual character, whereas Joel, who has lived his entire life in the trappings of the ministry, suffers when it comes time to apply sort of your religion to the test of the real world. And I think that's a tension you see in the courtroom, that's a tension that you see in day-to-day life, and that's a tension that you see certainly in religion. It's easy to be religious, I suspicion, when things are going well. It's when crunch time comes, how tightly do we hold on?
But in this case, I mean, he is a man who does not easily grasp for the sinful. He made a mistake at some point. He kissed a teenager. I'm going to give away a little bit of your plot here, just so people understand that.
And make sure you do the really sort of the colorful parts. Kissing a teenager. Maybe that'll sell a few copies.
but perhaps did not do what she accused him of. But because of that, he loses his parish, his wife, the life he knew, goes to jail. And then it seems like every time a lifeline is thrown to him after he gets out of jail, it comes with many strings attached, i.e. to more sins, more lying, more deceit.
Part of the something I see every day is people ask me about Joel in this book, and how could he make all these bad decisions? And the one thing I know from my day job vocationally is that so many novels are done as what I would call a parabolic plot or a parabolic structure. Someone is down and you reach an apex. And then you collapse again, and then perhaps you have some recovery, some redemption. And having sat in court and seen what I see every day parade through, the one thing I understand is that redemption sort of comes in fits and starts. It is not this wonderful linear progression that we see in so many novels. And I know some readers and some reviewers have found that frustrating. Why would Joel make these bad decisions? Why would he end up in one quagmire after another? And the point is that in one thing I know for sure, I may not know a lot of things, but in real life, people make bad decisions. I sit in court and I watch people backslide. I watch people, you know, why did you do that? I mean, why do you have a dirty drug screen this week? Why did you make this bad decision? And that's the one thing that I wanted to deal with in the book and make it realistic along those lines. And again, I don't want to. We were talking about Tom Wolfe earlier, and I saw Tom Wolfe do an interview recently, and he said, as writers, our primary objective should be to give readers their money's worth and to entertain them, that is certainly the theme of the book. But I hope that folks don't get the idea that it is a moralistic tale and a cudgel with which you're going to be beaten every time you turn a page.
No, I can attest for you that it is not like that. And Tom Wolfe did come to mind when I was reading Plain Heathen Mischief, because it reminded me of some of those woebegone types in his novels who they make that one bad mistake, and then there's this spiral, this descent, and it seems like they're essentially good people at their core, but they cannot climb out of that.
Well, the good news is after the descent, there's a happy ending. There's redemption around the corner, although it's my peculiar brand of redemption. Once again, something that you asked me early on, I mean, how much do you translate from circuit court into fiction and into real life? And that's something I see. Sometimes endings are not as pat as you would like, but they do have some measure of happiness in them. And that's there's redemption here. It's a peculiar brand, I would say, at the end. And I hope that, again, that sort of reflects a little more of the real world than some fiction would.
Yeah. Getting back to the real world for just a quick moment, as a judge, and you've been a judge for better part of a decade now?
I started when I was 32 years old in 1992, and you can do the math. I've forgotten it now. They're like dog years some days.
So you have a baker's dozen years as a judge.
Yeah.
What's the most jolting thing that you've ever seen come before you in court?
Oh, wow. No, no one's ever asked me that, especially not live. I would say this, generally speaking, the most difficult. I just finished a capital murder case. My job, I do everything from capital murder to speeding tickets. But I would say this, that the most difficult part of the job, I don't know if it's the most jolting, but it's the one that you take home with you. It's not the very raw things that you see. It's not the bad crimes. The most difficult thing that I have to do would be child custody. And it's not the child custody situations in which a child is in danger or a child is being abused, because those are very straightforward. They have an easy answer and they're easy to solve, and you leave with a feeling of accomplishment. You have done something.
Because it's more black and white there?
Oh, it's very black and white. You've taken a child from a bad situation and given that child some equilibrium and some sanctuary. The difficulty is in straight-up custody cases, when you have two very, very good parents and the custody case becomes sort of fly-specking and nitpicking over the smallest things, and at the end of the day, because of maybe some geographical separation, especially in my part of the world where we have a lot of dislocation because of work. People are laid off from work, and you have to move to another part of the world. And, you know, not even Solomon can work out an equal arrangement with someone living in Kansas and someone living in Virginia. And at the end of the day, you basically have to say to someone, you're going to be marginalized as a parent. And that is awful. Two good parents, really no separating factors, but you've got to make that decision. That's awful, and I don't enjoy that. I used to be a JNDR judge, juvenile and domestic relations, and that's principally what I did in circuit court. Now I don't do as much of that, but that certainly doesn't have a big wow factor, and it doesn't drop your jaw. But as a judge and as a person, that's the most difficult thing we do. That's the one you take home with you, and you just you feel sorry when you know for the folks involved when you go home, and there is no answer to it.
Mm. We're talking with Judge Martin Clark, who is also author of the novels The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living and Plain Heathen Mischief. The number's 1-877-962-9862. Are you religious yourself?
I am. That's a very direct question, isn't it? By the way, that's not 1-800-BIG-LAW. You know, don't call in with your legal questions and for the free legal advice. I'm not very good at that. I am religious, and I've often debated telling this story. I used to not tell it, but with my first book, The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, I spent 20 years getting rejection letters. I could not get published. I could not give the book away. I mean, and the remarkable thing is it's a business, and you probably know this about luck and timing. I mean, the book that I could not give away becomes, you know, a Book of the Month Club selection, a bestseller. It's sold to the movies, and it's all about being in the right place at the right time. But I struggled for 20 years to get published. And in a fit of sort of puerile desperation, I vowed to the Lord one day that I would give all of my money from the book to the church, thinking it would be about $5,000.
Did you get on your knees and pray? Was this kind
I didn't. I did it coming home from work one day when my agent had called and said, you know, there's a chance that Knopf is going to buy your book. I really think this is going to happen. And I'd heard that before and ridden that roller coaster and always ended up on the short end of the stick, to mix a whole lot of metaphors. And I said, you know, I'm going to give all my money to the church. And then the book hit, and I gave all the money, now six figures, to Stuart Presbyterian Church. I'm hesitant to say that because it sounds a bit like grandstanding, but it is a good story. And I asked my minister about it, and he says, "Well, you know, it certainly underscores the way perhaps the Lord works." And so I've gotten my wish, and I guess the money's gone to good places.
And you have said that if you had reneged on it, you had a fear of pox and
locusts
descending. Yeah,
people say, "Well, did you give it?" You know, the punchline is, "Did you do that?" I said, "Yeah." You don't cut the corners, you don't cut the margins on that deal. I don't need a trick knee and pustules and locusts and all that. Yeah, I did it, and that's not one you can cheat on very well. So, the second book, Plain Heathen Mischief, I pocketed for myself minus the 10% tithe. And I went to my minister and I said, "Well, what about the movie rights to the first book?" And he said, he's very legalistic. I like that. And he said, "Well, what did you promise?" I said, "All the money from my book." And I could just see "book" in italics when I made it. And he said, "Well, you can keep the movie money." So I've done that. And that's my ticket out of the courtroom.
So you're thinking of leaving the courtroom?
I was planning on quitting this August, and I've done it for a long time. I mean, I'm 46 now. I've done it since I was 32, and I was planning on quitting this month, and a number of things happened. We had an awful, awful tragedy. One of my close friends and my colleagues lost a son in a house fire in Oxford, Mississippi, and he retired.
The father, the judge.
He was a judge. I'm sorry, I wasn't very clear about that. He was one of our judges, and I just thought that it was not a good time to leave and have perhaps two newcomers in on our bench at the same time. And I still like the work. I still very much enjoy it. So I'm going to stick around a little bit longer. But it's a wonderful feeling. We're not elected in Virginia. We're appointed. We mimic the federal system, and it is a wonderful feeling to knowing that I will never go back to Richmond and be interviewed again. It is just a wonderful freedom and liberation.
You're judged for life.
I'm like Papa Doc Duvalier. I'm judged for life. I'm judged at least to the end of this term, and I'll never go past that.
I do want to ask one more question, though, about the church getting the royalties from the first book. As is often the case these days, when companies might sponsor a wing on a building, it becomes the Wachovia Bank wing, et cetera. Is there a wing at the church that's the many aspects of mobile home living wing?
Or we could get a triple
wide. Or is it a trailer?
We could get a triple wide and do some sort of annex. No, the precondition that I gave when I made this decision and I talked to the individuals at my church, the money could not be used for brick and mortar or organs or stained glass. It all goes to people. And I live in a really small town. There are 800-900 people in Patrick County. And as a coincidence, about the time that this word leaked out, you know, the book of Matthew says to be a quiet giver, and I'm not sure I did that. But as word leaked out, we started a building project. And a lot of people attribute that to the many aspects money. And it is not. Not one penny has gone into that building project from that money.
Okay. We are talking with Martin Clark. He is a circuit court judge in Southern Virginia and the author of The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living and Plain Heathen Mischief. Both books are now out in paperback. Just ahead, we'll get more from Martin Clark and also hear about a rejection letter he got once, and he'll read from that. That's all ahead. We welcome your calls here at The State of Things. The number's 1-877-962-9862. Martin Clark and your calls ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Judge and novelist Martin Clark is with us in the studio today, and we've been talking about the things that intersect in his books, mainly faith and the law. His novels are The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living and Plain Heathen Mischief, rather rollicking affairs. But there's more. I don't know if the titles certainly are provocative, but they may not do justice to a lot of what you're talking about in there. I mean, there's fun in these books, but are they morality tales too?
Well, I think that if you're a writer, you should be able to do three things. And again, not to flog this to death, but I think you should be able to tell a good story and take readers along with you. And I think that you should be able to do something with language more than sort of pedestrian prose. And at the end, I suppose the third thing you should be able to do is to move your reader just a little bit, to change a perspective a little bit. And that certainly could be on a moral level. And books that deal with the law and religion clearly have a big potential for a moral payload. So they certainly have moral issues in them that are addressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should also say that a reviewer in New York Times Magazine described you as the drinking man's John Grisham.
I'm stuck with that forever now. In my own defense, let me say two things about that. The first thing is that the whole quote was the thinking man's John Grisham, no, even better, the drinking man's John Grisham. And I like the drinking man's John Grisham better because people are quick to sort of denigrate what John Grisham does, and I actually like him as a writer. I've heard perhaps aspiring writers say, oh, I could do that. I could do what Grisham does. And the answer is no, you couldn't. You couldn't sit down and write a compelling, plot-driven book every year. Grisham does professional entertainment at a very high level, and he realizes that. Moreover, in terms of his first book, A Time to Kill, great plot arcs, good themes, good writing, just an excellent book. I mean, it's certainly not maybe an American classic, but it's maybe a B-League American classic, and I don't say that to disparage the book, but that's a fine book. So I'm a little bit defensive in the sense that I don't think it's fair to be so cavalier about someone like John Grisham.
But on the other hand, that was his first book, and the rap on him is that it's a formula. It's being churned. It gets churned.
But it's a good formula, and he sure churns it well.
Okay. So, well, you have...
I'm not as highbrow. I'm not as highbrow as some of the folks you'll have drop by.
All right. Well, I should say that your books also have plot going for them, but there's a lot of character. I mean, characters in them. We are talking with Martin Clark, and if you want to join us, the number's 1-877-962-9862. Mike is in Raleigh. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. This has been fascinating. I was sitting out in my garage not wanting to come in to the house because I'd have to turn the radio off and miss something. But I wanted to get the judge's opinion on something. I have a background professionally as in social work, but when I think back about kind of my academic preparation, I think I probably learned more about human behavior and what drives human behavior from the literature courses I took or, you know, other courses where we used novels than I did from actual, like, practice courses. And I was interested to hear him talk about how the things he sees in his courtroom have informed some of his novels. And I was just curious for him if he had had a similar experience of literature kind of helping him understand the people that he encounters in his daily work.
Hmm. Well, that's a two-part question. I'm not really certain that I could say that I've gained a particular insight from a book that I've read and applied that to a situation, a person, or a personality that's come into my courtroom. And you may have just heard what I told Melinda. I'm a bit superficial as a reader myself. That having been said, the other part of the equation, the second prong of that question is, and I think that's true. I have seen so much in the courtroom. I often talk to editors, and will tell them that if some of the stuff, if I wrote some of the stuff that's true, that's factual, that actually happens, if I put that in a novel, you would redline it and you would delete it because you just wouldn't believe it. And of course, being a JNDR judge, I work very closely with social services. And if you've done that, you have seen incredible things. You've seen incredible, I suppose, on both ends of the spectrum, good and bad, all sorts of human nature. You know, sad, happy, and surprising, and it makes for good literature. But I actually believe that you have to water it down, and you probably know that. I mean, you have seen things, and you will go home and you tell people, and they'll say that's hyperbole, that's just over the top. So it's remarkable that you almost have to water down the truth to make it good fiction when you're dealing with some of the stuff that's funneled through court and of course through social services.
Well, Mike, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
A question about writing fiction, because this is fiction, is you can take license. You're saying that you actually water it down, but there's that element of truth that you need at the kernel. At the center of that. I've heard that in judging, the big part of the job may be trying to figure out who is lying or who is the bigger liar
who
isn't lying between the two people in front of you. Is that the case?
One of the great reactions I get from juries and people who are not acquainted with the system, they will actually look at me as someone is telling a just Byzantine, Rococo lie, an awful lie. And they will look at me, this strange expression, as if to say, stop that. That man is lying on the witness stand. He took the oath. The volume of, what should I call it, the volume of untruths that we see in court every day is phenomenal. It will absolutely take your breath away.
So and can I think, you call people on it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you do. I mean, occasionally you do. It seems pointless after a while. You call them on it by ruling the correct way and discounting what they've told you. But one of my friends who used to be a Commonwealth's attorney said to me, if a single lie stood between me and the penitentiary, I'd tell it. And there's also, in, I think, rural areas, there's also the unwritten code that it's tolerable to perhaps lie for your brother, your mother, or your father. I mean, would you lie if let me give you a scenario. If you thought that your husband was innocent, he didn't do something, he had been accused of a crime, and you know he didn't do it, but he needed an alibi, would you get on the stand at his request and say he was with me? Tricky stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, where do your priorities lie? I mean, are you wedded to an abstract oath and this system of justice, or are you wedded to your husband and your family's best interest? It's not as black and white as people would like to think. So we tend to tolerate, at least in my judicial circuit, a little bit of fudging for your close relatives.
Right. And of course, in movies, if the wife does go on the stand and provides that alibi, it turns out that you know, he was the murderer.
Yeah. Yeah.
We go to the phones again. Donna is in Raleigh. Hi, Donna.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I would just love to comment on that judicial system, but I called to talk about fiction. So
wonderful. Thank you.
I'm a nonfiction writer starting to toy with fiction, and I wondered about your character development. I haven't read the books, but I heard mentioned that there are a lot of characters. Whether you develop characters and keep a lot of background material on them that doesn't make it into the story, or if you tend to write and more let the character tell the story as you write it?
Interesting question. In my first book, it's very, many aspects is very character driven, and those characters were created from whole cloth. The new book, Plain Heathen Mischief, is much more plot driven, and when I wrote Plain Heathen Mischief, it was very organic. I actually had the beginning, middle and end plotted out before even started. Some people find that difficult to believe, but it may be changed 5% from conception to completion. The other thing I would tell you as an aside is that most characters, at least for me and other writers with whom I've spoken, most characters have their roots in somebody or some person that you've come across or known. And you take that, and as we were saying earlier, maybe there's a core there, maybe there's something central, and embellish it. And it's nice to be able to do that in fiction. In terms of nonfiction, it's probably a little more risky.
Yeah. Well, Donna, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
You know, the first book, Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, that has as its main character this well, stoner judge. But you started writing this way before you became a judge.
Yeah, I started Many Aspects when I was in college at Davidson. There are actually a couple of riffs and a couple of paragraphs in Many Aspects that I wrote when I was in college. By the time it was published, they were a little dated or a little little wooden in terms of the quality, but that's where I started.
So that book was 20 years in the making.
20 years and a basement full of rejection letters.
Yeah, and you have one of those rejection letters here with you, and I was wondering if you might...
I'll be happy to. It's no big surprise. I brought it. And the very quick backstory is that when I was living in Charlottesville, going to law school there, and I knew that I wanted to be a fiction writer, I also knew it was very difficult to get a first fiction novel published if you were a nobody, and I decided I needed a literary sponsor and someone to hold my hand and lead me through the labyrinth that's the publishing world. My friend Charlie Wright and I, and this is not Charlie Wright, the celebrated poet, it's my friend Charlie Wright, he who fears the black helicopters. Charlie and I bought sort of ninja outfits and obscured the license plate on his Jeep. We located the residence of a very well-known Charlottesville writer, headed out into horse country, and I took my manuscript and put it in the writer's mailbox. Along with a bottle of scotch, as you know, sort of a quid pro quo. Hope you'll read this. Also, think that if you're drunk, the book might read a little better, and I might get a little bit further. And about a month later, I got my manuscript back with a letter in it. And you actually looked at this before we went on the air, and you can confirm.
I can confirm it's a handwritten letter. Half a page, half an 8.5 and 11 by page, both sides written on handwritten.
It's dated 4 December 1982, and it begins, "Dear Mr. Clark," the first paragraph reads, "On page 55A, you make reference to a floral arrangement with a telephone. This is already used in the book Wise Blood and the movie by the same name. So much for my efforts at cutting-edge originality." The next paragraph reads, "Your book is cynical and clever. As to getting it published, I don't know much about that. That's what agents are for. This is not the person who's going to help me through the labyrinth that's the publishing world." In the final paragraph, this is absolutely classic, probably the best rejection paragraph ever written, says, "As to mixing law and literature, it would seem to me you'll either be a half-assed writer or a half-assed lawyer. Literature is a full-time passion. Sincerely, Rita Mae Brown."
So have you caught up with Rita Mae Brown since this book did get published 18 years later?
Yeah. We were at a William Styron celebration, and I did not know she was there. And I actually had mentioned that letter and read it. It was in a few newspaper accounts as well. I saw her afterwards. She was delightful. And my reading it was nice of her. I mean, she was white hot then. It was nice of her to read it. It was nice of her to invest the time in it. It was nice of her to write me back. So when I read it, there's no malice in it and no ill will. And she was very generous and very funny. She told me she remembered the manuscript, and I think that was true. There's not much doubt in my mind that she did. She recited a passage from it. We signed books beside each other, and she told me that she appreciated the liquor, but she, quote, gave it to her stable boy, which reminded me of something out of D.H. Lawrence.
Great. So she had advised you to be a full-time writer or a full-time person of the law. You'd been the full-time person of the law, either as a lawyer or a judge, for the better part of two decades now, and you were saying a few moments earlier that you'd like to be able to retire but can't do that now. Are you working on another book at the moment?
I have another book. I write every morning because I enjoy writing. The lady, I think her name was Donna, who called from Raleigh, you know, was talking about writing and doing nonfiction. I think that you need to you really got to like doing it. People who get into the business, or I guess it's not business, the art, for money or for other reasons, generally don't do so well. I mean, you really have to like it. And I love doing it. I get up every morning and I write. I try to do a page a day. In my obsessive compulsive way, I figure that I'll have 365 pages, basically a novel done in a year. It never works that way, but I get up and I have chickens, I have a rooster, and he crows, and I write, and I love doing it. To be honest, I've just been in trial for a couple weeks, and I didn't do as much as I would have liked, but I really enjoy doing it. The new book, let's see, I'll try this out on you. Let's see if this resonates with you. The name of the book is 0.08 or 0.08. Ring any bells with you?
What you blow on a breathalyzer.
Yeah, okay. See, it's wonderful. Everybody knows that. Yeah, everyone. It's people.
Maybe not through direct experience. But yeah, okay.
And so that's the title. It's called 0.08, and I have about 128 pages done.
Really? And yeah. Does it involve a minister or a judge?
No, I suppose, was it William Kennedy did the, what was that, the Albany cycle, the Albany trilogy, or Cormac McCarthy did something. I don't have a name for my trilogy, but I wanted to do law and religion and now politics.
And politics. All right. Well, Martin Clark, we look forward to that book when it comes out. Thank you for joining us today.
And thank you so much for having me.
Martin Clark is a circuit court judge in Southern Virginia and the author of many aspects of Mobile Home Living and Plain Heathen Mischief. You can get them in paperback. And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about our program, if you'd like to write to us at least, that address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Thank you for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.